Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. A lawyer is looking into why Aboriginal and Northern Affairs won't let a Northern Ontario woman touch her trust account. This year, a record number of Sisters in Spirit vigils were held across the country, including one in North Bay. A new study links ADHD in Inuit children to mercury. Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation has launched a constitutional challenge to Shell's application to expand the Jackpine oil sands mine, and the Nunavut government is targeting smokers with a new campaign. All these stories plus great tunes all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. The Canadian Press reports Aboriginal Affairs has released new calculations that show First Nations students receive just as much, if not more, funding as non-Aboriginals for schooling. The federal government has been under scrutiny for years from First Nation and human rights groups and opposition critics for underfunding First Nation education. About a year ago, all parties agreed to fix the problem and end the inequalities between First Nation and non-Native primary and secondary schools. But in a background attached to an October 2nd announcement on building new schools, government officials attached a raft of calculations that suggest student funding is already at par. Aboriginal Affairs says it spent an average of $13,542 for each student in the 2010-2011 school year, not including money for infrastructure and building maintenance. That compares to a national per-student average of $10,439 in 2009, according to StatsCan. But this contradicts numbers from the Assembly of First Nations that shows First Nations receive about $7,101 for each student on average. And the NDP says the federal math is faulty since it lumps in students who go to school on reserves with students who attend provincial schools. A Timmins woman hasn't been able to access her $100,000 trust account. Agnes Sutherland is wheelchair-bound and has been living a destitute life for a few years, even with that money in the bank. Sharon Sabourin, a Sutherland lawyer, says she's given a small amount of money to live on each week. Sutherland has restricted access to her money, which was part of the residential school settlement, after the public guardian and trustee for Ontario was appointed to act as administrator for her estate. Sabourin says she was retained by Sutherland about 2 years ago to help rescind the Indian Act legislation that restricts her from her money. Sabourin says before that time, Sutherland had been going through a rough period.
She was going through a period of alcoholism and ended up in the MHU at the hospital. And as a result, there was a recommendation that she be made an incompetent person for the purposes of the Indian Act, and therefore a recommendation was made to the Office of the Public Guardian and Trustee to manage her property or be an estate administrator for her.
Sabourin says her client has been sober for more than a year now, and a physician has conducted a capacity assessment on Sutherland, deeming her capable of managing her own affairs. Sabourin says she's been trying to get Aboriginal Affairs to rescind the Indian Act section keeping Sutherland away from her trust account. And Sabourin says a court date has been set for next month to try and get the federal government to deal with the issue. The federal government has been billed more than $3 million to fight the child welfare case. The Canadian Press reports the large amount of money was to try to keep the high-stakes battle over First Nations child welfare out of the courts. Invoices obtained through access to information showed the Justice Department, acting on behalf of Aboriginal Affairs, paid out at least $3.1 million for legal services between 2007 and June 2012. Government lawyers were trying to quash claims from First Nations child rights advocates that Ottawa is shortchanging Native communities by funding child welfare services at 22% below provincial levels. The First Nations Child and Family Caring Society and the Assembly of First Nations launched a human rights challenge that dates back to 2007. They say the federal government is discriminating by not providing the same level of child welfare supports to First Nations children as other children in Canada receive from provincial governments. Ottawa has challenged the advocates with legal technicalities at every step along the way, arguing that the case does not belong in the courts. After much back and forth and more than $3 million later, the federal court rejected the government's arguments, ordering a full hearing at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. A new study published in Environmental Health Perspectives links attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, in Inuit kids to mercury. Dr. Gina Muckle is a Laval University researcher and co-author of the study. She says the research started in the early 90s in Nunavik, and they learned that frequent marine mammal consumption led to high mercury levels in newborns. Researchers followed the babies for 11 years. Muckle says the higher mercury levels resulted in higher rates of ADHD.
What we observed was that children with higher cord mercury concentrations were about three times more likely to be identified by their teacher in the classroom as exhibiting behaviors that are characteristics of the inattentive type of ADHD. So that's the main and I think most important result with regard to prenatal exposure to mercury.
Muckle says another component of the study showed that low lead exposure resulted in negative behaviors also associated with ADHD. Muckle says lead is found in ammunition used to kill game. She says preventive measures could include decreasing consumption of beluga meat and also international dialogues to regulate mercury emissions. The applications for membership of the newly created landless Newfoundland band Halibut are continuing to pour in. CBC reports officials had initially expected about 11,000 applications, but that number could reach 65,000 by next year. There are concerns that the large volume could stretch the resources of officials looking at those applications, and those applications will also be audited by the federal government. And Halibut will be holding its first election on October 23rd. Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation has launched a constitutional challenge to Royal Dutch Shell PLC's application for approval of the proposed Jackpine Oil Sands Mine expansion. Ariel DeRanger is the communications coordinator for ACFN, and she says they weren't properly consulted or accommodated.
That constitutional challenge is based on the fact that we feel as though the government and Shell has not adequately consulted with our First Nation or developed adequate accommodations. So there has been no sufficient sort of communication between the government, the oil company, and us. And that's in relation to what the impacts of this project would have, the cumulative impacts, and the fact that we don't feel that the government has a full knowledge or understanding of what ACFN requires in order to meaningfully exercise our rights within our traditional lands. So our challenge is based on Section 35 of the Constitution Act 1982.
DeRanger adds that Aboriginal consultation and accommodation is handled in a haphazard way across the country. And she adds the expansion to the Jackpine oil sands mine would affect water and land and would also expand the impact zone affecting bird and caribou migration patterns. All 41 complainants will get to testify when a Nunavut priest goes to trial for 76 sex abuse charges alleged to have occurred in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Nunatsiak News reports 65-year-old Eric de Jager pleaded not guilty October 1st to the indictment stemming from his time in Iglulik and Baker Lake. According to the report, the native of Belgium became a Canadian citizen, studied theology in Edmonton, and became a Roman Catholic priest. He has been in custody since January 2011 after Belgian authorities discovered he was back in that country. They returned him to Canada where police arrested him and flew him to Nunavut. Crown attorney Barry Norton told the news outlet De Jager's trial will start in October 2013 and is expected to take around 10 weeks because of the large number of alleged victims of his crimes. A Sisters in Spirit vigil held in North Bay and Nipissing was one of nearly 200 held across the country. The vigils, part of a Native Women's of Canada campaign to raise awareness about the over 600 missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls in the country, were held on October 4th. Adrienne Pelche, Social Services Director at the Anishinaabeg Nation, says it's important that people learn about the effects of violence.
The people need to realize that there's a lot of suffering that occurs when there is violence in the home with the children, and then also with the young people. They may end up leaving home to escape violence, but then end up in worse places on the streets of our major urban centers. So, you know, violence can leave traumatic effects for all people that are involved in their family.
166 Sisters in Spirit vigils were held across the country, as well as a number of international vigils, including 5 states in the U.S., along with Mexico and Bolivia. Nunavut is trying to reduce tobacco use among residents. It's been reported that smoking rates there are double the national average. A campaign entering its second phase is aimed at urging people to butt out. The campaign is called Tobacco Has No Place Here. People's stories around tobacco are called for in the campaign. Ariette Korgak, manager of the tobacco program for the government in Nunavut, says they've received many great stories, and he says one of the most powerful stories was that of a cancer survivor.
Another story, you know, that came out was of a person, you know, in the Kivalliq region in Rankin Inlet, who recently went through cancer treatment for throat cancer, and it was a really powerful message, because he actually brought along And there's a poster of him, you know, holding of a picture of him, you know, showing his when he was going through chemotherapy, of what the cancer looked like, you know, from the outside, and he just said, you know, this is what I had to go through for 7 weeks, and I don't want anyone to go through this, you know.
The program also provides aids for quitting, which includes a helpline and online calculator, plus other online supports. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Yes, I keep it there, quasi. Yeah.
That was Shakti Hayes with Nitsamos. The Anishinaabeg Nation has teamed up with the North Bay Friendship Center to host a Sisters in Spirit event this year. Adrienne Pelche is the Social Services Director at the Anishinaabeg Nation, and she hopes the vigil will be the first of many annual ones.
The Union of Ontario Indians, along with the North Bay Indian Friendship Center, have partnered to bring a Sisters in Spirit walk to the Nipissing District. It'll be on October 4th, starting at 10:30. We will be walking from the Union of Ontario Indians on Highway 17 down Main West and up Castle Street to the Friendship Center. There will be a morning agenda at 10:30 with some opening remarks from various dignitaries, and we will be raising awareness to honor the lives of missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls and support families who have been tragically touched by the loss of a loved one to violence. So that's just to raise awareness about family violence issues and the effects on our women and children and families.
I also understand something else that's pretty cool is that there's a record number of Sisters in Spirit events happening across Canada right now.
The Native Women's Association of Canada this week, and they said that there were over 100 vigils taking place. So this is a record number, and you know, it's great that so many communities are raising awareness of the issue of family violence.
Yeah, so it seems that awareness around these issues are growing, and so tell us, how important is awareness around these issues?
Well, you know, the people need to realize that there's a lot of suffering that occurs when there is violence in the home with the children, and then also with the young people. They may end up leaving home to escape violence, but then end up in worse places on the streets of our major urban centers. So, you know, violence can leave traumatic effects for all people that are involved in their family.
And so what kind of resources are there in Nipissing and North Bay to help families go through a grieving process after losing a loved one to violence?
Well, there is the Nipissing Transition House in the city of North Bay. And on Nipissing First Nation, there's the Ojibwe Women's Lodge.
And what do they provide?
They provide shelter services, information, advocacy. So people that are looking for information on how to escape the violence or to help them get supports and healing, they can contact their local shelter for those kind. They also have crisis lines at the shelters, so people that are in crisis can call and get some support as well.
And so what other kind of education and awareness is out there targeted towards young Anishinaabe women?
Well, the Native Women's Association of Canada is doing a phenomenal job of providing resource guides and information through their website, through their main office. And if people want to get more involved, we will post some of their links on our website, in our newspaper, and provide them at the vigil tomorrow.
And have you been holding this vigil every year?
Oh, actually, I was approached by the Friendship Center, some of my colleagues over there, and we decided to partner this year and get the vigil going. You know, we may change it up from year to year, but I think this will end up being an annual event for us.
That was Adrienne Pelche, Social Services Director at the Anishinaabeg Nation. About 166 Sisters in Spirit vigils were held across the country on October 4th to remember missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls in Canada. Mercury and lead levels are a concern in Nunavik. A new study published in Environmental Health Perspectives links attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, in Inuit kids to mercury, and low lead levels have also been found. Here's Dr. Dina Muckle, a researcher with Laval University and co-author of that study.
We started to do studies looking at effects of prenatal exposure to environmental contaminants in Nunavik during early 1990s. And we found out at that time that because of their frequent consumption of marine mammal meat and fish, because of frequent consumption of marine mammal and fish, the Inuit population was highly exposed to PCBs and mercury. So there was a monitoring program going on in the beginning of the 1990s where we collected blood sample from the umbilical cord of the newborn, and we followed this group of children up to age 11 years. And recently, we published the results showing that, and I think this is the first most important result of this follow-up, is that prenatal exposure to mercury was associated with greater attention problem and with increased risk of teacher-reported symptoms consistent with ADHD. So that is in relation with prenatal exposure to mercury. What we observed was that children with higher cord mercury concentrations were about 3 times more likely to be identified by their teacher in the classroom as exhibiting behaviors that are characteristics of the inattentive type of ADHD. So that's the main and I think most important result with regard to prenatal exposure to mercury. There's another significant result, another key result that came out in this follow-up at age 11 years old, is that lead exposure during childhood was associated with greater aggressive and rule-breaking behaviors and with behaviors consistent with ADHD. But this has been shown in studies before, studies that are conducted in the United States. So that's not a new result. But this result is interesting because it shows that the negative effects of childhood lead exposure on child behavior is seen as at very low level of lead exposure.
And so where are they getting that lead exposure?
The lead exposure in the Inuit is very specific. It is very different than the source of exposure that are known in southern population. In Nunavik, it is known that lead exposure is mainly due to past and present use of lead shot for harvesting wild game. You know, when you use ammunition that are containing small lead bullets, this small lead shot goes into the flesh of the animal, and you can ingest those small lead bullets. And this is how people get most highly exposed to lead.
So with this information, how are people able to prevent exposure to mercury and lead?
That's a very good question. And since we were able to figure out what was the main source of lead, and there are ammunition that are not containing lead that are available in the market, it's just a question of which kind of ammunition that are used for hunting. And the public health direction of Nunavik in 1998 banned the use of the lead containing ammunition in Nunavik. And interestingly, we saw that lead exposure has decreased after that ban. But unfortunately, the use of lead shot has resumed. And, I think in terms of community or public health intervention, just not using such kind of ammunition will end up with a significant decrease of childhood exposure and adult exposure to lead. So that's an easy intervention that can be done. With regard to mercury, this is a little bit different. We know that More about 55% of the mercury intake in Nunavik is due to consumption of beluga meat. So the public health director decided during the fall of 2011, when we communicated the results of this research to the Nunavik population, so that was 1 year ago, the public health recommendation that came out was that pregnant women and those of childbearing age should decrease their consumption of beluga meat. Because beluga meat is, you know, the main source of mercury intake. However, mercury is a natural contaminant, a natural metal that is found in the environment. But there's a lot of mercury traveling from developing countries like China and India to the north. So there's a lot of mercury deposition in the north and the environment, generally speaking, that comes from countries that are using that are burning I should say that mercury travels between countries through air currents and reach the Arctic as well. And mercury emissions are primarily due to coal combustion for production of electricity. And China, for example, was identified as the largest source of mercury deposition in Canada. So there is the need for international actions, international agreements about how much mercury emissions are allowed in specific countries. So that would be a good way to decrease mercury exposure. So there is the personal action with regard to decreased consumption of beluga meat, and there is potential an international action which is to regulate how much mercury emission is between countries.
That was Dr. Gina Muckle, a Laval University researcher. Now here's Andrea Menard with
Peace. In the valley, there will be peace. In the valley, there will be peace. In the valley for me, there will be love. In this family, there will be love. In this family, there will be love. In this family for me, there will be light. On this journey, there will be light. On this journey, there will be light. On this journey for me. But if I want peace in the valley, if I want love in this family, if I want light on this journey, it's up to me. 'Cause I am the peace, I am the love, I am the light, the light.
Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation has launched a constitutional challenge to Shell's application for approval of the proposed expansion to the Jackpine oil sands mine. ACFN says the company and government has not adequately consulted or accommodated treaty rights. Now here's Ariel Deranger, communications coordinator for ACFN.
So ACFN has basically filed a question of constitutional law or a constitutional challenge against the application that was submitted by Shell Oil Canada for an expansion of their Jackpine Mine tar sands project. And that constitutional challenge is based on the fact that we feel as though the government and Shell has not adequately consulted with our First Nation or developed adequate accommodations. So there has been no sufficient sort of communication between the government, the oil company, and us. And that's in relation to what the impacts of this project would have, the cumulative impacts, and the fact that we don't feel that the government has a full knowledge or understanding of what ACFN requires in order to meaningfully exercise our rights within our traditional lands. So our challenge is based on Section 35 of the Constitution Act 1982.
And so what does your community require as far as fair community consultation goes?
So this is a big problem. In Alberta, what we're seeing, and probably actually across Canada and maybe even North America, is that consultation has been really haphazard. It changes from region to region, province to province, and even from sort of project to project. So whether it's tar sands, coal, uranium, so on and so forth, everyone has sort of a different tactic on consultation and accommodation, and there's no sort of deeper understanding of what our treaty rights are and how we meaningfully exercise them. So there's an example of that is there's no baselines on what is necessary for fish habitats in order for First Nations to adequately fish properly. There's no baselines as to what the water quality needs to be in order for us to utilize it as we spend time on the land. There's no adequate baseline studies on berries and medicines that we use traditionally or how we traditionally utilize caribou and moose and bison and so on and so forth. And until we have a full understanding that encompasses traditional ecological knowledge and Western science together that creates studies that identify those baselines and what it means to meaningfully practice our traditional rights and cultural rights, it's impossible for us to create mitigation and accommodations for those rights.
So as far as the proposed expansion goes, what would that affect?
Well, the proposed expansion in Alberta for the Jackpine Mine would be expanding their existing projects in the Jackpine Mine region, developing a larger tailings mine or an N-pit mine lake, and increasing production by 100,000 barrels a day. So, you know, we're talking about massive water licenses to take more water from the Athabasca River system, which is a system that our community relies on not only for transportation but for fishing, for the migratory patterns of certain animals. And it's a traditional sacred water site of our people. It's what the people refer to as the heart of our community. And we're talking about more impacts within expanding their impact zone to further go into critical habitats, migratory routes of birds, moose, caribou, so on and so forth that reside within the region. And it, of course, an increase of greenhouse gas emissions and contamination to the river system and the ecosystem that is already sort of at its almost at the top of what it can handle. And so we're already seeing increases of toxic contamination in the region, and we really cannot afford, as not just as Dene people of northern Alberta, but as people of Alberta, as people of the country, as people of the continent, as people of the world, to move forward and destroy, you know, the Athabasca Delta, which is one of the last remaining intact freshwater deltas of the world. So we have to talk about the protections of ecosystems, people, and the planet, and that's really what we're doing. So ACFN has really taken it upon themselves to draw the line. This project would be in our traditional territory, and we have the ability to assert our rights as sovereign nations to say we don't want this project in our recognized territory, and it's time to draw the line and say enough is enough.
You were talking just earlier about there not being any adequate baselines to look after the water and the land and several other things. And has ACFN set baselines of their own?
We're currently in that process. So over the last few years, probably about 5 years, we've really sort of taken it upon ourselves as a community to look at what are those things? What are those things for our communities? How do we adequately protect them? community has really taken it upon themselves to develop those studies on our own. So we've hired scientists and we've done mapping projects with elders and traditional knowledge holders to map out those things, to identify those things so that we know which areas need to be protected, what kind of plants are picked, when are they picked, those kinds of things. So we're in the process of developing that, which is why we don't think that we need to be throwing an approval of a project in the process of trying to identify what those baselines really are for our community.
That was Ariel Deranger, Communications Coordinator for Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. Imagine living a destitute life and wheelchair-bound with about $100,000 in the bank that you're not allowed to touch. That's a true story, and it's happening to Agnes Sutherland, a member of Attawapiskat who is currently living in Timmins. The money in the bank is from the Residential School Survivor Settlement. Agnes's lawyer is Sharon Sabern, who will tell us what's going on.
Ms. Sutherland is a client who retained me almost 2 years ago now in order to challenge the finding that she was incapable of managing her own finances. She was going through a period of alcoholism and ended up in the MHU at the hospital. And as a result, there was a recommendation that she be made an incompetent person for the purposes of the Indian Act, and therefore a recommendation was made to the Office of the Public Guardian and Trustee to manage her property or be an estate administrator for her. And so from there, she ended up getting sober, and when she's sober, she has no difficulty whatsoever managing her own affairs and no cognitive impairments of any kind. And so we had a physician, she lives in Fort Albany, or I should say lived in Fort Albany, and in Fort Albany there are no physicians, local physicians, there's no hospital, there's a nursing station, and that's about it. So there are doctors who fly in on occasion to assist with the people who are there. And at the time, Dr. Nevins, who has a practice in Moose Factory, had flown over to take care of some patients that day. And so we had asked her to attend at Ms. Sutherland's residence, which she did, because, as you may know, Ms. Sutherland is in a wheelchair, and the roads in Fort Albany are very difficult to navigate at the best of times. But this was in early spring, and there was lots of mud, and she really couldn't navigate anywhere. So Dr. Nevins attended at the home and conducted a capacity assessment and found that she had no difficulties and was fully capable of managing her own finances. So she sent a letter to us, which we then forwarded to the Office of the Public Guardian and Trustee, and the Office of Public Guardian Trustee then forwarded on to INAC. At the time, it was Indian Northern Affairs Canada. And from there, we just never received a response. It I think, just went into a black hole. And lots of follow-up letters, lots of requests, and just no response. On one occasion, one time, about a year ago, I think it was in June of last year, 2011, I got a call from somebody in Thunder Bay from the INAC land mining claims, that sort of division of INAC in Thunder Bay, who mentioned to me that he had received my letters and that he was just getting to responding, and never heard back from him since. So since then, in about December of last year, Agnes left her husband, and her family is all up in Fort Albany still. She has 6 children and 16 grandkids up there. She decided that she was going to leave her husband, and so she came to Timmins. When she arrived in Timmins on December 23rd, she had nowhere to live, and she explained to me that the shelter had some difficulty accommodating her because it's not wheelchair accessible. And so she slept in her wheelchair and tried to find warm places to be and surround herself with people that would help protect her and other homeless people, and has been living on the streets since.
Wow, that's pretty sad. Is there any reason why do you think Aboriginal Affairs is not responding to this?
I don't know. I suppose they may be overworked and understaffed. I don't know. I don't think there's a real reason why they wouldn't respond, because even if there was something wrong with the form that I sent, you know, they would respond and say, this isn't the form that we need, or we need something different from the doctor, or, you know, they would follow up in some fashion to say that there was some insufficiency. I've just had nothing, absolutely nothing. And so the only assumption that I have, the only inference that I can draw from that, is that there isn't enough people to do the work to respond. I mean, there is a chance, too, that, and I don't know, there's a chance that in reading the Indian Act myself, I don't see a very clear provision for the trusteeship to be revoked. There's very clear provisions for an estate trustee to be appointed, but there's no follow-up section that says this is how we have somebody's appointment revoked. So I wonder, maybe there's some glitch there, and there's some, you know, legal, I guess, statutory interpretation that would apply, because typically what happens, the Indian Act is a federal statute, and what it says is that if a person is found to be mentally incompetent within the purview of the provincial legislation, so in Ontario, our provincial statute that applies is the Substitute Decision Act, and in there are certain criteria that need to be met in order for somebody to be found incompetent, and my assumption is that's the criteria that applied at the time when that recommendation was made. So the finding of incapacity was made pursuant to that statute, but the appointment of the estate trustee was pursuant to the Indian Act. And so even though now we have somebody at the provincial level who's saying, yes, she's got capacity, perhaps the difficulty is that the Indian Act doesn't have specific provisions to then release that appointment. I don't know.
Well, I certainly hope something gets done soon. Winter's just around the corner. And so how's Agnes right now?
Interestingly, I found out just yesterday that she was able to find a little apartment. So it's not wheelchair accessible, and I mean, it's not luxurious by any stretch, but she has shelter now, and that's fantastic. So I'm not sure, you know, what sort of amenities are close by or what appliances. I don't think there's any appliances. I don't think it came furnished with anything. So she's still got, you know, some challenges, but at least she's got shelter for now. I also received an email from Charlie Angus, who's our local MP for James Bay and Timmins, and he offered to assist with liaising with the social services housing department to help get her some housing. So I think for the short term anyway, we're good, and it looks like some people are starting to step up for some longer term solutions.
That was lawyer Sharon Sabarin in Timmins. Now here's Tracy Bone with Your Own. Is battling tobacco use and has come up with a campaign to help residents take a look at their own use or how tobacco use has affected their lives. Now here's Ariet Korgak, the manager of the tobacco program for the government of Nunavut, to tell us about this campaign.
The government of Nunavut approved a tobacco reduction framework for action in 2011, about a year ago, I guess, in October, November of 2011. And that set the stage, you know, to started the campaign to reduce tobacco use and cessation support across Nunavut. The campaign itself started or was launched in January 2012 during the National Non-Smoking Week, and continued since that time. We have implemented the or starting to implement, you know, the plan, and we're just working on the second phase of the Tobacco Had No Place Here, and it's part of the framework itself. It's a 5-year plan, and as I said, in 2012 the campaign was launched, and early results, you know, showed really positive response, you know, and support, you know, from the communities.
And so I know that you're right now you're looking for stories, and so what kind of stories are you looking for?
I guess we would continue the what we started in January 2012, and that was, you know, to get people to think about tobacco use, the harm it does, you know, to individuals, families, and Nunavut in general. But that wasn't the sole purpose, you know. The idea was, though, that we needed to start a dialogue in Nunavut about tobacco use, and part of the campaign, you know, was to get people to come forward and share their stories, and we had a very good response, you know, from across Nunavut, and we're going to continue that that campaign that this year. Right now, our tobacco team have visited two communities with two more to follow. And when they are in the communities, while recruiting people to get stories, you know, they are also working at the with the schools, with the communities, and to engage, you know, the public. The individuals, so that has continued. What we look for is for people to share their stories, you know, either as smokers, ex-smokers, never smokers, you know, just to so that, you know, they can share their stories, you know, with the with people across Nunavut.
So what are some of those stories on how tobacco has touched people's lives?
I guess going back, you know, to what we heard, you know, when we started recruiting in 2011, and then when we launched the campaign in 2012 in January, I'll just share a couple of stories, you know. One was of an elder who lives in Baker Lake. He's in his, I think, late 70s. And he had been smoking most of his life. About, I guess, 3 years ago, he decided to quit because, you know, he had like chronic illness. You know, he wasn't very healthy, I guess. You know, so he decided to do something about it. You know, and so he quit. He quit smoking. After, you know, he probably had been a smoker, you know, for over, I would say, close to 60 years. So that's one story. Another story, you know, that came out was of a person, you know, in the Kivalliq region in Rankin Inlet, who recently went through cancer treatment for throat cancer. And it was a really powerful message because he actually brought along and there's a poster of him, you know, holding of a picture of him, you know, showing his when he was going through chemotherapy, of the of what the cancer looked like, you know, from the outside. And and he just said, you know, this is what I had to go through for 7 weeks, and I don't want anyone to go through this, you know. So that was one message. Another message, you know, that came out, you know, we have an elder, you know, who is in her early 80s, who has never smoked, and she shared that story, you know, with the people. So we have individuals, you know, that are never smoked in their lives, you know, never drink. So these are the type of stories, you know, that are coming forward, you know. We also had a younger generation, you know, where there was a mother, you know, who said, you know, because she was smoking when she was pregnant, you know, her son was affected by her smoking, and she shared that story with us. So these are the type of stories, you know, that are coming out, and I cannot say, you know, at this point, because I haven't seen the stories coming out right now, you know, but we hope to continue, you know, lead that powerful message, you know, that is coming out, you know, that smoking has no place, you know, in the Inuit society.
That was Ariette Korgak, manager of the tobacco program for the government of Nunavut. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.